Though once characterized as the land of opportunity, America has become the most unequal country in the developed world, with the most homelessness and child poverty, more people in prison than China and Russia, and less upward mobility than most European nations. In his new book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice, activist and author Les Leopold offers a primer that explains how we got here. The deregulation of Wall Street, the cutting to the bone of social services, the slashing of taxes on the wealthy, and the financialization of our entire society. Again, the name of the book is Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice, and we welcome Les Leopold to the roundtable this morning. Les, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. What brought you to wanting to write a guide, and especially an activist guide to economic justice?
Well, I actually got pushed in this direction by my son, who was entering college and doing an internship in New York. And he came home several times, really disturbed by the number of homeless people he saw lying around the streets. He said, you know, we're such a rich country. How can this be? How can this happen? And I was sort of struggling to come up with an answer. And I thought, well, maybe I'll do a book on homelessness to find that answer for him. And as I got into it, I realized that the core problem wasn't homelessness. The core problem was runaway inequality, and that it was impacting the entire society. So the book's kind of dedicated to him for pushing me in this direction. And I think we've answered some of his penetrating questions.
You look back to, say, 1980 or so, where these problems, these structural problems, started to develop. Give us a sense of the history of where we started to see the framework which brought us to where we are now.
Good. Let me do it in two ways. First, let me just do it numerically, because the picture is really clear. Back in 1980, the ratio of the top 100 CEOs' pay to the average worker was 45 to 1. $1 for the average worker, 45 for the top CEO. They were living pretty well. It's now 829 to 1. It's gone from 45 to 1 to 829 to 1. An enormous explosion like in no other period of American history. So we had to account for that. And in your intro, you did a darn good job in doing it, actually, which was there was an enormous change in economic philosophy in this country that captured both political parties. And it was deregulate the corporate world, get the government out of the economy, cut back taxes on the wealthy, and trim back social benefits so that people would be hungrier for work and they wouldn't depend on the government. And this was supposed to create an enormous economic boom. But the dirty little secret of that plan, which we call in the book the Better Business Climate Plan, the dirty little secret was deregulating the corporate entities like phone companies or airlines or trucking is not the same thing as deregulating Wall Street. When they deregulated Wall Street, they let the genie out of the bottle, and there was an explosion in Wall Street incomes. And the reason there was an explosion is they figured out how to strip mine the rest of the economy, financially strip mine, move money from the real economy, as they call it, to the financial economy, so that by 2006, 40% of all corporate profits were on Wall Street, even though only 5% of the workforce worked on Wall Street. And that process is sort of like the whodunit part of the book. We try to help people understand that financial strip mining process.
How much of it is Ronald Reagan's fault?
Well, he unleashed this thing, but actually it began in the Carter administration with the deregulation of credit cards and some of this other forms of deregulation that began. And Ronald Reagan gave it a big, big boost, but so did Bill Clinton. And basically, it's very difficult to find a political figure, except for a few, the exceptions that prove the rule, that have not bought into some part of this Better Business Climate model. They don't know what else to do. And so they keep doubling down that if we just deregulate some more and cut back government interference in the economy some more, cut taxes a little bit more, we're going to get that boom. It's sure going to happen. But there are two conclusions from this book that really blew me away. The first one was that runaway inequality is not going to cure itself. Recessions, income growth again, none of that is changing runaway inequality. Since the Great Recession of 2007-2008, there has been a recovery, But 95% of all the new income generated has gone to the top 1%. So there's no magic pendulum in the economy that swings from extreme inequality to less inequality. That leads to the second conclusion, which is that we're going to have to build a very sizable mass movement to challenge Wall Street on the key issues that make runaway inequality happen. And we're going to need a movement that's kind of like Bernie Sanders on steroids. It's going to have to be a big movement and sustain itself for a long period of time. This is a deep, deep, deep problem that impacts every issue virtually that the people who are listening right now care about.
You spoke a moment ago about the better business climate. I want to go back to that for a moment. So when that came into the picture, was that idea wearing a white hat or a black hat?
Oh, it was wearing a white hat. People were enthralled with it. This was the modern world. This is what we should do. No, there were very few people who were questioning. I was in graduate school right then, Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton, and I was watching the way the economists were all adopting this idea that, you know, we'd have a more efficient, bountiful economy if we just got the government out. Nobody taught anything about finance. That was the amazing thing. Nobody at the time, the black hat part was, I don't think very many of the economists that were advocating this or policymakers understood what would happen when you deregulated Wall Street.
Okay, so you don't think, because I understand the white hat part of the reception of it, but in its creation, was there a black hat a part where there was something malevolent in its creation?
I'd say not at the beginning, but that that tendency that you just described started to happen once the deregulation started on finance. Because then they kept asking for more and more and more and more, to the point where they, in 1999, got rid of Glass-Steagall, which was a bulwark of the protections we had starting with the Great Depression, separating gambling banking, investment banking, from insured banking, commercial banking, where we put our money. These strict controls, each one of them virtually got undone, but it didn't happen all at once. Savings and loan happened. There were a lot of black hats involved in that, as you know. 1,000 people went to jail. Notice how things have changed. Virtually no one has gone to jail as a result of the shenanigans in 2007 and 2008. But so there, as pieces got deregulated, there became a hunger on the part of Wall Street to deregulate more and more and more. And if you read any of the books about the period, you can see how they go down to Washington to the various regulatory agencies and various key Congress people, and they just keep pushing and pushing and pushing. And they become part and parcel of every administration. A revolving door starts going back and forth between Washington and Wall Street.
You write about in the book wage theft, and you have a very broad definition when it comes to wage theft. Talk to us a little bit about that and how it is really more than just unpaid overtime.
There's a key chart in the book. I joke when I do workshops saying this is what's going to be on your final. There's only going to be one chart on your final. This is going to be it. And it shows productivity in the United States since 1947, and then it shows the average real wage, the real buying power of income between for the non-supervisory and production worker, 85% of all working people. When productivity rose in that post-World War period, so did the average real wage. The standard of living got better for nearly everybody in the economy. Inner city people as well as suburban people, it was going up and up and up and up until the mid-late 1970s. And then the two lines split apart like you can't believe. I'm in graduate school right when this is happening, and I'm being taught that it's an iron law that the two have to rise together, that productivity and wages have to rise together. No sooner do I graduate, they repeal the law on me. And wages go down a little bit and go stagnant for the next generation. Meanwhile, productivity continues to rise year in and year out. We are three times as productive per hour of labor. We produce three times as much stuff now as we did in 1947. So where did all the money go, the gap between the two lines? Well, there's another chart in the book that looks exactly the same, and that shows financial wages versus non-financial wages. So the money has gone into the financial sector, into the top CEOs. So I call that wage theft because for 25 years, actually even longer if you go back through history, when productivity went up, that productivity was shared with working people. Some of it went to capital. It didn't all go to working people. It went back into plant and equipment. But about two-thirds of it every year went into improvements in the wages and conditions of working people. And then that stopped. That premium was taken away from working people, and I call that wage theft, as defined as wrongful taking, because really there's no reason that that money should not have been shared with the average working person. A CEO was making about $1 million a year compared to an average worker of about $35,000. Now it's $30 million a year. I mean, it's just it's obscene, and, yeah, that's why I use the phrase wage theft, because I'm saying it's not just the poor guy, an immigrant on the street corner that goes to work and then they don't pay him because they say, well, who are you going to complain to? You're not documented. It's not just, overtime theft at McDonald's. It's productivity theft for 85% of the workforce.
Les Leopold is the author of the new book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. After the crash of 2008, how did things change?
All the changes that happened after 2008 are negative as far as I'm concerned. The largest banks, the top four largest banks, got bigger. They actually now have 45% of all banking assets in the country are in the top four banks. So they got bigger. As I mentioned earlier, 95% of the income went to the top 1%. So in fact, the wage theft problem we just talked about is getting worse. Inequality is getting higher. After there was a little dip, when the whole economy was crashing, and now it's gone back up again. And we have this horrendous problem with the too big to fail, too big to jail. I don't believe any of the new Dodd-Frank stuff is capable of stopping that. If one of these big banks goes down, we're going to bail them out again.
When it comes to what we've heard so much about in the various attempts statewide as well as national to raise the minimum wage, what do you make of that? And then also talk about how that's related to something you write about in the book, which is the establishment of a maximum wage.
Well, that's a very, very good question, because we have to do two things at the same time. We have to pull people up from the bottom, and a $15 minimum wage is definitely a step in the right direction. You know, McDonald's in Denmark, the pay is $20 an hour. In New York, it's $9 an hour. And the cost of living is higher in New York than it is in Denmark. So you've got this anomaly where the same corporation can afford to pay 20 an hour but not 9 an hour. So we could definitely have a very prosperous economy at 15 an hour. But if that's all we do, we're not really going to tackle the problem of runaway inequality. We're going to have to constrain wages at the top end. For example, we could have a kind of graduated income tax that if your corporation it goes above 45-1, you start paying a penalty in taxes as a CEO, that we could discourage CEOs from trying to have an 8-29-1 ratio. Another thing we could do that's extremely effective, and this proposal is now being talked about and something that I wrote about 5-6 years ago, is have a very, very small financial transaction tax on all Wall Street transactions of bonds, sales on bonds, stocks, and derivatives. Very, very small, fraction of 1%, would generate from $150 to $350 billion a year in revenue, which could be used to really help students in America. We could have free higher education with that money, free higher education at all public colleges and universities throughout the country, and we could begin to retire student debt, which would make an enormous difference to students and their families across the country. If we took that $150 to $350 billion out of Wall Street, we would do a lot to constrain the top end, and we could rebalance our economy in such a way that would actually make it much more vibrant. There are a few more technical things that we need to do as well. The other way to constrain it at the top is to actually set up real competition for Wall Street banks through public banks. We have a very, very – the most profitable bank in the country, nobody realizes this, is the Bank of North Dakota. It's a public bank owned by the state of North Dakota, and its CEO makes $250,000 a year. The ratio of CEO pay to average worker pay in that bank is something like 8-1, which is, if you, when you poll the American people and ask them what they want the ratio to be, a strong Republican will say 12-1, a strong Democrat will say 5-1, for an average of about 8-1. So if we had 50 state banks across the country and their movements pushing for this, including a postal bank, we could go a long way to making Wall Street more competitive, and therefore their wages would come down over time. So, yes, we have to constrain the top and bring up the bottom. And all this is all laid out, I hope, in a very clear fashion in the book.
When it comes to Wall Street, there are, of course, many proposals for changing and improving the system on Wall Street and making it fairer. Which do you think actually have a shot of becoming a reality?
That is an excellent question. The reality is a function of how much mobilization we do and what kind of education we do in the field. By the way, this book is being used quite wildly now in a national education campaign that we're part of. And all the royalties from the book don't go to me. They go back into the campaign. So we're trying to put our money where our mouth is about building the kind of force we need to make the rule changes and law changes that we will need in Washington. What has a chance of success? I think the financial transaction tax has a chance of success if we mobilize a large enough movement. And I think there's a rule change, which is, might be a bit obscure to people, but there's a certain rule that allows companies to buy back their own shares and enrich their CEOs, which I call financial strip mining. And if we could change that rule to what it was before the Reagan administration changed it, before 1982, that was called stock manipulation. And then they changed the rule. So now 75% of all corporate profits go to buy back their own shares. And that's done to enrich the value of the shares owned by the investor, the top investors and the CEOs. That's a disastrous rule. And I think there's some chance that over time we could change that. But again, it's a function of how well educated we are, how what kind of movement we build. This is not logic alone is not going to solve this problem. It's a question of power. As runaway inequality took off, and this is the really sad part about this, did a lot of collateral damage, because when a lot of money is in the hands of a few, they can buy political power. So both political parties are vying for Wall Street money. There was an excellent study done by two economists, political scientists at Princeton, where they looked at the last 1,700 bills that were in Congress, and they said that the average American, the median American, had absolutely no influence over public policy the way it's set up right now, which is a shocking result. Anyway, so we do have to mobilize ourselves if we want to both make this a genuine democracy again and influence public policy, as your question implied.
Of course, we've been talking about all of us in the sense of those who are basking in the inequality, if you will. If you go in and zoom in and take a closer look, what do we also then learn about race and gender and class?
Yeah, this is the part of the book that actually worries me the most, right up there with the decline of democracy. It turns out that when we adopted the Better Business Climate model, it signaled the end of the war on poverty and all the efforts that were being made to create jobs for people in inner cities, high unemployment areas, in places like Appalachia as well. There was a focus on that. Some of the programs were good, some not so good, but there was a constant effort because we recognized that youth unemployment, especially amongst minorities, was approaching 50, 60, 70%. We had to do something about it, and then we stopped. The war on poverty ended. Here's what happened. The prison population in the United States exploded. If you look at a chart going back to 1910, the prison population was steady in the United States. And then as inequality took off, the prison population rose in tandem, identical year for year for year. They rose and rose and rose. We now have the most prisoners in the entire world, both in absolute numbers and as a percentage of the population. How can that be? How can America have the most prisoners in the entire world? Well, in my estimation, prison became our war on poverty. That's where people tried to find work in the underground economy, in the marginal areas of the economy, couldn't find work elsewhere. and then got sucked into the prison system. And it has terrible consequences. Eric Garner, Staten Island, the man who was arrested and died during that arrest, what was he doing? He was working. He was selling loose cigarettes. That was his job. That was his war on poverty. So we've abdicated our responsibility. During the same period, by the way, childhood poverty shot up as well. We now are of a list of 27 countries around the world. These are developed nations. We're second to last. The countries that have the least inequality, Northern Europe, they've eradicated childhood poverty. And you asked about race. We go back to the prison population. There always was a slight gap between white and black prisoners going back to 1910, but the gap has really grown since runaway inequality hit, and now young people, way more African American young men are in prison than ever before. The odds are now 1 out of 3. Catch this: 1 out of 3. That an African-American male will find himself in the criminal justice system sometime during his lifetime. And many of the infractions are driving while black, things that are totally unnecessary, right. Stops and violations. So, yes, there's a racial dimension to this now that makes it even harder and more difficult for us.
Les Leopold is the author of the new book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. The book is published by Labor Institute Press. Les Leopold, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I greatly appreciate your expertise.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Runaway Inequality, An Activist Guide to Economic Justice. It is published by Labor Institute Press. Les Leopold is the author. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.